Frank Borman and his crew and all of our engineers are unanimously in favor of selecting this mission. We have reached this conclusion after a long series of intensive investigations as of the status of our program, the flight hardware, the ground support equipment, and the status of our training. The timing for the December 21st launch is conditioned by the position of the Earth and the Moon and the Sun. It's designed to give us daylight in the launch area and the recovery area, and then designed to give us the right kind of photographic and observation light on the surface of the Moon. The outbound trip will occupy about 3 days. The time in orbit around the Moon will be about a day, involving 10 orbital swings around the Moon with about a 3-day return, actually adding up to something just slightly over 6 days to the recovery.
The mission that we've decided to fly with Apollo 8 is the mission for which the Saturn V was designed, and insofar as the Saturn V is concerned, it won't know the difference between this mission and a lunar landing mission. And it's also, in most important respects, the mission for which the Apollo spacecraft was designed. The exception in the case of the Apollo spacecraft, of course, is that there is not a lunar module aboard, and the command and service modules will make the trip to the Moon without having the LEM docked, and that's the exception. But in most important respects, in terms of the knowledge we'll gain, it is the design mission for the Apollo Saturn V space system.
Astronauts Virgil I. Grissom, Edward White, and Roger Chaffee were killed tonight in a flash fire during tests of the Apollo Saturn 204 vehicle at Cape Kennedy Air Force Base. The fire occurred while the astronauts were in the spacecraft during the countdown of a simulated flight test. The accident occurred at 6:31 Eastern Standard Time at T-minus 10 minutes prior to the planned simulated liftoff. The spacecraft was located 218 feet above the launch pad and was mated to the uprated Saturn 1B launch vehicle. Hatches on the spacecraft were closed. Emergency crews were hampered by dense smoke in removing the hatches. A number of launch crew workers were treated for smoke inhalation at the Cape Kennedy dispensary. The crew entered the spacecraft at 3 p.m. Minor difficulties had been encountered during the count with the environmental control and communications systems. All data has been impounded pending an investigation.
The facts briefly are that at 6:31, the observers in the pad area, those in the immediate vicinity of the spacecraft on the tower, and the television monitors in the blockhouse and in the spacecraft checkout building, heard a report which originated from one of the crewmen that there was a fire aboard the spacecraft. This report was essentially at 6:31. Our data will reveal exactly what time in terms of seconds. This was, as I say, a radio and intercom report that there was a fire aboard. Now, the condition at that time was that the spacecraft and the crew were at T-minus 10 minutes from a simulated liftoff and holding. And there was, to the best of my ability to determine so far, no activity going on except preparing to pick up the count and getting ready to proceed with the test. The observers report that there was what I would call a flash fire, which originated inside the cabin. This flash fire penetrated the spacecraft, apparently, and was observed to essentially surround the spacecraft for an instant, and this is time that can be determined later, a matter of split second or very, very few seconds, as a flash of fire which surrounded the spacecraft exterior, but having originated in the interior. The spacecraft crews in the pad area proceeded immediately with emergency equipment to the spacecraft, and in spite of fires that were then burning in the area of the spacecraft, to extinguish these fires and immediately to proceed to open the spacecraft. The crews on opening the hatch report that there was intense heat coming out through the hatch. There was very dense smoke as well coming out from the spacecraft.
There's always a possibility that you can have a catastrophic failure. Of course, this can happen on any flight. It can happen on the last one as well as the first one. So you just plan as best you can to take care of all of these eventualities, and you get a well-trained crew and you go fly. The space program, more so than anything we've done in the past, has given a stimulus to the young people and the very young children even, and in a goal for them and a purpose for them to educate themselves as well as they can to their own capability, and to have, even though they're not going to be obviously all become astronauts, but they, if they start out with a certain goal when they're young and the goal is properly directed, these young people, I think, have a much more of a chance of becoming useful and well-educated citizens who will take care of you and I when we get older and we don't have the capability to direct the world. The young people will run our world for us when we get older.
Mr. Maynard, the lunar module, one of the most complex piece of space machinery ever designed, has a long history evolving into this bizarre-looking craft which we now expect to land on the moon. How did it come to be this way?
When the NASA decided to use the lunar orbit rendezvous approach to lunar landing, inherent in that decision was to do so with a good and proper spacecraft that fulfilled the functional performance requirements in sufficient detail so that the vehicle would be safe, reliable, and would represent the best capability that the country had to build a vehicle.
Was a concept thrown out to the aerospace industry, to the big builders of airplanes, to try to play with, to come up with better designs or to interpret? How did this happen?
Yes, it was sent out to the major contractors as a request for proposals, and we gave all of the proposals to Grumman, and Grumman looked through the good features and the bad features of each one of them, and worked on improving, modifying, and really basically changing an awful lot of the concept that they originally proposed. And it through this nine contractors' proposals, we've got here essentially the good features of each incorporated into the final vehicle.
When was the lunar module, as we know it, pinned down? What year did Grumman then begin building the actual vehicle? Do you know?
It was about, it was in 1963 when Grumman started on the studies, and they studied the configuration for about a year before we committed certain pieces of hardware to this configuration. And of course, in the about four years, it has evolved in rather minor detail since then. Well, some things not so minor, but it's generally been configured like this for 3 to 4 years.
Thank you very much, Mr. Maynard. Owen Maynard, Chief of the Systems Engineering Division at the Manned Spacecraft Center. This is Rhett Turner. Mr. Maynard, all of the models I've seen of the lunar module are painted black and white, but after seeing the lunar module in the production line, it looks quite differently, the real thing. Why does the limb look like it does?
With respect to the color of the lunar module, the major environment it has to contend with is the thermal environment of deep space, that is, contending with the high energy from the sun and radiating to the cold of deep space when it's not looking at the sun. So the optical characteristics, the ones that you see, are very much related to the thermal characteristics with respect to absorbing energy and radiating energy. So the colors you see are a function of what the thermal coating requirements were in order to withstand the great range of thermal environment. The slab sidedness and the corner, sharp corners, and the apparent lack of concern about aerodynamics is evident throughout the lunar module.
I like the way you describe it. Why don't we say, I would rather say, how did it look like a bug?
Well, the reason that it looks rather ungainly with respect to no aerodynamic cleanliness is that we had no requirement to make it look aerodynamically clean, and we didn't put any requirements into it that it didn't need to have, because it had enough of them. Mm-hmm. Now, it has the, let's first of all talk about the appendages, like the landing gear.
The spider's legs.
Yes. The reaction control system quadrants, and the antenna, the front porch that the crew gets out on to get on the lunar surface, the radar, the bays that stow equipment in the descent stage, and the access hatches and the docking tunnel at the top, and so forth. The original proposal from Grumman had five landing legs, and the current configuration has four. Mm-hmm. Some of the proposals that were submitted had as many as six and eight legs. Mm-hmm. The numbers of reaction control engines on each of the proposals, in fact, were different. Each one of the proposals had a different number of engines. We currently have 16 engines on the reaction control system engines. They, of course, are to control the attitude and provide the ullage just before you fire the main engines. And they, of course, have to be sticking out a long way from the center of gravity in order to give you the take advantage of the moment arm to minimize the amount of propellant that you would use to fulfill a, to perform an actual a particular maneuver. Mm-hmm. So they get, those engines get stuck away out, The landing gear legs get stuck away out in order to give stability on the lunar surface. Mm-hmm. The antenna gets stuck away out and away from these engines so that the plumes don't adversely affect the antenna. The rendezvous radar has to be away from the engines, but it does have to be close to the inertial measurement unit of the guidance system, and so forth. Now, let's get to the question of tankage in the descent stage. The Grumman proposal had more tanks in it than we currently have in the descent stage. We have four. There was a difference in the original proposals. We had a different number of tanks, different number of landing gear legs, different number of reaction control system quadrants. Now we have four legs, four tanks, four RCS quadrants. And when you kind of think about it, the structural arrangements now become pretty practical, where you, as long as you've got the same number of everything, you can package it a lot better. Mm-hmm. So that we can have the RCS engines firing between the legs rather than some of them firing between the legs and some of them firing right on top of the legs. And of course, mm-hmm. that would give you a hard time on the legs where the engines were hitting them. And give you different control moments and so forth, and the ability to house and support the propellant tanks. Now you end up using the same primary structure that you use to support your landing gear legs. Now we use the same primary structure for the landing gear legs to support the whole lunar module to the spacecraft limb adapter in the launch vehicle during launch. And now we have an opportunity to pick up on some hard points at the ascent stage to the descent stage.
All of this makes good sense looking at a model here as you describe it, when you begin to see how all these things came together. Something that occurred to me is the fact you alluded to a few moments ago, and that is that it has no requirement to be aerodynamically smooth. We don't have to see smooth, straight, or curved surfaces. The things we need to see are practical coverings and a practical arrangement of the equipment needed, and that's what's evolved then.
Yes, that's right. I think the as soon as you can get away from the idea that it has to look pretty and you have it fulfilling the functional requirements, and once you understand those functional requirements and you look at it and you say, my, doesn't it fulfill those functional requirements beautifully? And you say, it sure is a beautiful-looking vehicle, then.
And that's what you, as an engineer, are doing.
Yes, it looks very nice to me. It is very much like the P-51 Mustang fighter plane was near the end of the Second World War. It compared to the Spitfire, the Tempest, the Focke-Wulf 190, was a very angular-looking airplane. But when the operational people, like myself, came to understand why it is that it was built like it was built, it became a very pretty airplane, especially when it performed so well.
Well, Owen Maynard, thank you very much for describing this for us, and I must say you sound like a parent describing a child of which you're very proud.
Yes, and we don't want to have too many changes in this child from here on in.
Thanks again, Owen Maynard. This is Rhett Turner in Houston. Mr. Maynard, one of the interesting changes as the design of the lunar module evolved was that of the hatches and or docking tunnels. You originally had two docking tunnels through which astronauts could crawl. Now that has changed. And also, there's a somewhat lopsided look about this lunar module. Well, first of all, how about the docking tunnels?
Well, the original proposal from the contractor was to have two docking tunnels to fulfill the requirement as was understood at the time. The top tunnel was for the top docking tunnel was the point where the command module would turn around and dock on the lunar module and pull it out of the spacecraft limb adapter. This had the same functional performance requirements as the Gemini docking arrangement had, except you had to also crawl through the interface.
The tunnel was in the middle of the connection.
That's right. And so this compounded our problems over the Gemini problems considerably. Now, the front docking tunnel on the original configuration was associated with providing the maximum clear visibility by the lunar module pilot of the command module when the lunar module is coming back to dock with the command module in lunar orbit, so that we wanted to have the best opportunity of fulfilling that docking. Now, it turned out that out of one of these two tunnels, you also have to crawl to get to the lunar surface. And when we add that additional functional requirement to the tunnel of crawling through it and getting to the lunar surface in 1/6 of a gravity with a backpack on and so forth, going down the lunar surface, come back up, it was anticipated to cause considerable problem with the design of the suit and the backpack themselves. We, at the same time, early in the configuration development, found that the LEM pilot could, in fact, look over his head quite nicely through a small window above his head, and he could see sufficiently well a target on the command module that would permit him to dock the lunar module with the same hatch that the command module had used in the transposition phase of the mission.
So then what did you do? You changed the front door to a hatch and just retained one docking tunnel?
Yeah, that's right. We deleted the functional requirement of the front hatch to also be a docking tunnel and simplified it considerably so that it could perform those requirements it had to perform much better. And it is still a certainly not simple case of opening up the door and walking through it. It's still a case of the crew having to get down on their knees and crawl through this hatch and out in the lunar surface, and it's made rectangular now that is a little bit better shape for the crew, the man with his backpack on, to get in and out. If it had been the docking arrangement, it would have been circular and would have been a little bit smaller, and it would have been virtually an impossibility at this point in time.
Why is the ascent stage of the lunar module a bit lopsided? Why is it a bit one-sided looking?
Well, in the original configuration, there were four propellant tanks, two oxidizer and two fuel. And on one side, we had an oxidizer tank and a fuel tank, and on the other side, we had an oxidizer tank and fuel tank. We found that these tanks were hooked up in series, and really they weren't redundant, and we found it was really much better to go to single tanks, larger, of course, than the individuals were, but we went to two single tanks, and when we did that, the oxidizer-to-fuel ratio was 1.6, so the oxidizer tank was closer to the longitudinal axes of the vehicle than the fuel tank was, in order to balance the moment of mass to get the center of gravity on the longitudinal axes.
In other words, do you mean that the amount of fuel weighs less than the amount of oxidizer that's carried?
That is correct, and that fuel is therefore farther from the axes.
To maintain the center of gravity right down the middle?
To maintain the center of consumables, the center of gravity of the consumables. So that the center of gravity of the vehicle will stay pretty much in the same place as well.
I see. Well, thanks very much, Mr. Maynard, for explaining two more interesting aspects of why the lunar module looks as it does. Thank you very much, Owen Maynard, Chief of the Systems Engineering Division at the Manned Spacecraft Center. This is Rhett Turner.